it could very well turn out leads back to a fire. You know, be cautious about thinking that that means that you're going to see football in the Big Ten in 3 weeks. You know, it's going to take a fair bit of time. If the Big Ten is going to return to, let's say, return to activity, what I would expect at this point, based on the Big Ten's actions, its protocols, its rules, what I would expect in all likelihood to see is something like a 4 to 6 week off season where programs know, okay, this is the committed amount of time we have to turn our athletes over to strength and conditioning staff to get them built up, to get them prepared physically and mentally for the season. Then that 4 week preseason camp, obviously allowing for the potential for shutdowns and delays, and then a start sometime in November. Again, I think it's been mooted, the potential of a December start. We've seen that in a few different ways at a few different times. So my point in all this is I do think the Big Ten seems to be moving toward, at very least, reconsidering its, let's call it its work stoppage, if you want to use that term. I think it's important to sort of caution against the idea that if the Big Ten were to decide to resume activity, that would just mean sports for you and me in 2 weeks. I think we'd still be looking at a pretty significant ramp up, frankly.
And the other part of the ramp up that we talk about, or maybe we don't talk about, or haven't talked about, or we're not going to hear about, is this just going to be, here's a date, let's go, and then in the coming weeks we'll give you the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey would say, about we're going to play, how we're going to play.
Given what the Big Ten has struggled with here in the last frankly, you would hope that any significant move forward at this point would have the Big Ten would have recognized the need to be much better about communication, about, you know, understanding, you know, where things, where they can be better in articulating their positions, in informing their coaches and athletes and athletic directors. I mean, you would hope that lesson has kind of been learned at the administrative level for the Big Ten. And I'm talking not just about Kevin Warren, but really, frankly, also as presidents and chancellors. If you are going to start this up again, you need to be a lot more open and a lot more detailed in the way that you sort of share the information that moves the conference forward, because it's clear that has been a big piece of the mistakes that have been made here thus far.
I hate to play devil's advocate, but you and I talk enough and you know where I'm coming from. If all this tea leaf pointing is for something to happen, why does Ryan Day get on his little soapbox today and write that scathing social media post about what is going on? It just doesn't seem like the streams are crossed rather than all acting together to bring down the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man.
And you may well be right. I mean, I think James Franklin also was once again sort of backhandedly critical of the Big Ten during a radio appearance earlier today. I'm not sure where I want to say, maybe ESPN radio somewhere, but again, just sort of criticizing the lack of transparency, the lack of communication that the conference's coaches feel like they got in all this. You know, listen, I've given up trying to read the mind of everybody in the conference to figure out what exactly is kind of going on through all this. I do think that, you know, you would be surprised, I think, if everybody just hops back on the same hymn sheet simply because the Big Ten says, hey, we can start back up now. I think that, you know, some of these relationships, frankly, have been strained and fractured. And it's going to take a little while to mend them and to rebuild some trust, you know, rebuild some mutual sort of understanding and communication. And that's why I think the Big Ten's got to get this right, if it is prepared to try and reverse course.
Zach Osterman's our guest from the Indianapolis Star. We heard also today, we've seen many college football writers reporting that the University of Minnesota is facing a $75 million deficit. They are looking at cutting men's cross country, or it's all men's sports, cross country, track and field, tennis, and what was the other one? That's neither here nor there. Oh, I have it right here. Let me see what I've missed here. Indoor track and field, outdoor track and field, men's gymnastics, and men's tennis at the completion of the 2021 season. So that doesn't jump off and say, football's coming back soon and everything's going back to normal. We can't confuse the two, can we?
Well, you know, I think you and I talked about this, and I don't know if this is something departments have talked about openly. I don't know if it's something they would talk about openly, frankly. You know, Iowa, I think, was the first Big Ten school, if I'm not mistaken, to cut sports.
Yes.
A couple of weeks ago, they cut men's gymnastics. I think men's tennis and men's swimming and men's and women's swimming and diving. I think those are the sports they cut.
Correct.
And not quite, but nearly simultaneously, Gary Barta, the athletic director at Iowa, announced that the department was working on the last steps in securing a $75 million loan. And I know you and I have talked about the possibility of basically borrowing against future earnings to cover shortfalls now for some of these richer athletics departments that can, you know, sort of ensure themselves of a certain revenue stream going forward once we can get things back to relative normal. And I've said this, I've used this example a few times. I think I've used it on here. I forget who said this, forgive me, but someone said this on Twitter and it made a lot of sense. They say that these sport cuts don't make a ton of sense if you look at the total cost annually. You know, you're only talking about maybe low seven figures, $3-4 million a year. When you're talking about an $80 million deficit, $3-4 million, sure, it's a piece of the pie, but it doesn't go that far. Is it really worth it? Now, the flip side, this point made was, I think it was actually Adam Jacoby, wonderful Iowa blogger. He said these sort of cuts make a lot more sense if you're clearing room in your budget for annual loan payments.
Ah.
And I think that maybe is a little bit of what you're seeing here, because one thing I think I've learned in all this in my job is that sports fans don't care as much as I thought perhaps they did about being sort of literate to the finances of sports.
They do not want to know how the sausage is made.
And please understand, that's not me criticizing them. That's me realizing that I'm a bit of a journalism nerd.
Yeah, we know. We know. Every Thursday.
Yeah. it has kind of surprised me, frankly. And I think one of the things that I think has been lost on a lot of fans is when we talk about these shortfalls, they're not getting paid back in one full whack. Like, you know, these sorts of costs are always going to be amortized. And it's just a question of how you manage the debt. In the same way that every time a university announces a new $50 million building or a new $20 million volleyball wrestling facility, whatever, people don't always appreciate it. Nobody's cutting someone a $20 million check.
That's not
saying,
how it works.
Okay, you are paying for that building through debt service over 15, 20, 25 years. And the debt that would be incurred, or the shortfall that would be incurred from these sorts that we're talking about right now in terms of losing football, losing game day revenues, and so on, that shortfall is not something you're just going to pay back in your next year's accounts. And that's why schools are talking about loans, is because they need to find a way to – it's not like, you know, taking out a loan to take a risk. It's that they need to find a way to cover the shortfall now that they can responsibly pay back over a period of years. And that's why
those programs aren't coming back. That's why they're not suspended.
Right.
That's why they're off the books.
Exactly. Because that, at least if let's put it this way, if the theory is correct, this clears room in your budget for annual payments. You know,
I didn't think of that either.
As you budget moving forward and you start to cast your mind toward what's our budget for 2021, 2022, or 2022, 2023, and on and on, well, here you go.
People like to be mad. They don't like long, complicated answers. They just like to be mad. It's easier to be mad. It's easier to be angry at it. And that's what you see from some of these coaches who are quote-unquote leaders of these football programs. They just come out and bang their pots and pans and get mad about it. So it'll be interesting to see what moves on. We'll see if there's this magical vote or not magical vote. There is no timetable. I guess Kevin Warren was on the call with the presidents today. He always has a Thursday call. Did I see that on Twitter somewhere? That's fine.
You know, I didn't see that today, but I believe that the Thursday call has been a kind of a regularity through this whole process. And when I say this whole process, I'm talking about back into like the spring or summer. So it's not something that's necessarily, it's something that happens every week. That's not to say that they aren't having a serious discussion about a potential revote or a vote to reverse the decision or whatever.
Yeah. And they can basically do whatever they want. They don't answer to anybody. And I know that's hard for people to understand or whatever else, but it's the truth. And the presidents are the ones that can make, they can change this tomorrow. They can absolutely do it, but when you look at the greater scheme of things, a lot of presidents, and this is going to lead us into our next segment, do not care about athletics. That is not their mission. Their mission is not sitting around the table trying to figure out how to have a football season. Their mission is how to run in some cases, a multi-campus university system, or they have other issues. And I don't think that can be dismissed in this as well. And you've left me.
Oh, can you hear me? There we go.
You're back. You're back.
I think I had myself muted there for
you
a minute.
You did.
I use Indiana as the example all the time. And this is another one of those where sometimes maybe we as journalists fall in love with writing about how the sausage is made. In 2008, when Fred Glass was hired, Michael McRobbie announced in the hiring press conference that Glass would become a fully vested vice president within the university. He would essentially have a place in McRobbie's cabinet, for lack of a better term. Previously, the athletic director reported to someone within the university administrative structure who then reported to the president. This was eliminating that middleman, so to speak. But what it was also doing was making that athletic director's position not necessarily more autonomous, but certainly more sort of omnipresent day to day in the running of the department, because the director would be reporting directly to the president and therefore would be a much more sort of direct arm of the presidency, if that makes sense. And, I can remember writing that in 2008, nobody really caring, and I understand why. But when you get into a moment like this, it's an important reminder to say, presidents make athletic directors into vice presidents so they can say, hey, that's your corner of the store. You come to me when something needs fixing, when something's wrong, or when you need to deliver an annual report, or when you have great, great news. Other than that, I need you to be able to take care of that. The same way that I don't need to be calling the university CFO every five hours to see what's up with our finances, or the university general counsel every 2 days to figure out what's going on the legal side, or the head of research, or the vice provost for student affairs, whatever. It's about, a good president is going to hire people he or she trusts and then empower them to do their jobs and not meddle. And that's, I know this is kind of a tangent that will go somewhere else that we don't have to go anywhere else with, but that's why I'm always a little bit entertained with the fans who say they want McRobbie or they want McRobbie's successor, now that he's obviously retiring, to be much more involved in athletics. It's sort of like, you really don't.
Adam Herbert was involved in athletics. How'd that go?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yes, exactly.
He was a lot involved in it, like naming the coach involved in it. From everything I've heard and understood and read and talked to and people that were on the inside, the man had one name on a list and handed it to his athletic director. That's a story I'm told by more than one person.
And here's
so that's and, your
and
president.
Where did that get Indiana? Rather than trusting the person who'd been hired to do the job to
– It makes your point, doesn't it?
Produce results and bring success. It's just not. It's not the setup you want.
We could
and it's
argue.
Certainly not the setup you want right now in the middle of a global pandemic that is presenting all sorts of public health challenges to campuses and all sorts of financial challenges to university systems.
Adam Duvall had 9 RBIs last night, And the Braves scored 29 runs. The Reds have scored 24 runs this month, as the Braves were big winners. Zach Osterman is our big guest. And this discussion will come full circle after a quick timeout. Zach has written an oral history. 20 years ago today, the year 2000, the day September 10th, Miles Brand, the president of Indiana University, fires Robert Montgomery Knight in Indianapolis. There's two things right there that just don't sound right. We'll get into the they said you heard and you wrote about the main players in this game, and we'll reflect back on 20 years, and we'll do that after a quick timeout and Network Indiana News. 5:28, it's Glass in the Afternoon. It's Happy Hour with Zach Osterman. 5:31 at WGCL. Glass in the Afternoon, it's Happy Hour. That's right. The 10th day, the 9th month, the year 2020. It's gorgeous outside. 81 feels like 85, so it's a little humid, but it's warm. I don't know what they're talking about in that forecast about thunderstorms, this or that. Stretch it out, WGCLradio.com. You tell me where the next day of rain better than 20% is. We gave it a good fight. August rallied nicely. It looked green. Everything was looking in the right direction. And then we just haven't had much rain here in September, which, again, I don't have to cut my grass anymore. That's fine with me. Zach Osterman from the Indy Star is our guest here every Thursday. Matt Norlander, college basketball writer. A couple tweets from him. College hoops scheduling nugget. Sources tell CBS Sports that November 23rd recently emerged as a desired alternative season start date as opposed to November 25th, due in part to it being when multiple MTEs are scheduled to begin. No official decision on any date yet, but November 23rd is on the table. Well, that Maui starts on November 23rd. That's pretty good news, isn't it?
Yeah, you imagine that date was at a decent chance of getting moved back.
MTE is multi-team events, I'm guessing?
Yeah, I think it's multi-team events.
Something like that, okay. I know you would have at least a shot at that. So no news is good news on the college basketball front, or is this more of a naturally easier time?
I don't know that it's not no news is good news so much as it is. I think, you know, it's still where you'd imagine it was going to be, especially if they're going to push the start of the season. We're still like... we're still about two and a half weeks, I guess, away from the allowable start of practice anyway. So if you're going to move it back a couple more weeks, then, you know, it seems like good news to me if there are a lot of people figuring out these contingency plans now. You have to trust that we're only maybe getting the surface level of the contingencies, you know, to where some things might be located at Maui. I know for a fact has floated the idea of moving to Asheville. I think John Rothstein reported this week, or maybe even today, that even Indianapolis could be on the table for that.
I saw Sioux Falls, South Dakota, for the Battle for Atlantis.
Battle of Atlantis, I think. So as long as this is only kind of the surface level of what's being considered, and people are also working on a lot of other logistics, then I think it's fine that you are kind of in this position.
Well, and college basketball 20 years ago was in a very interesting position. Tell me how you put this oral history together that we could find in today's HT at theindystar.com. And how many trees did you have to shake to find all the participants in your monster oral history about the firing of Bob Knight?
Well, actually, to be honest, we worked on it for a while, on and off for a few months, just because, of course,
we knew it was coming.
This was the 20th anniversary of the event. And, you know, I should say thank you to everyone who gave their time for that story specifically, either those who were quoted or those whose quotes wound up, you know, getting left on the cutting room floor. Also imagined, you know, that frankly, there would be a lot of people who didn't want to talk, and I understood that.
Why do you think that is after 20 years? If Bob Knight can come back to Indiana University after all that time?
Yeah, I think there's a number of things. I think that was a very difficult time for a lot of people. I think it was and remained sort of very divisive in people's own, you know, minds. There was a quote that I think found its way into the end of that was actually taken by my colleague Dana Benbow from an interview with Todd Leary back in February when Bob Knight came back.
And, the last sentence of the piece, right?
Yeah, Leary said, you know, we used to have to choose between Indiana University or the Knight family, and we don't have to choose anymore. But for a long time, a lot of people did. And even people who maybe didn't have an immediate personal connection to Knight or the program or the university or the administration probably still felt like they did. And I think it was hard in that respect. I think there's a respect too for the fact, and I'll if we can talk about how the sausage is made a little bit, you know, one of the things that I was very conscious of in writing this is that there are people involved in this story, and you know, including though not limited to Miles Brand, who are no longer with us and therefore can't really even be afforded the opportunity to tell their story. You know, to know that Bob Knight himself is very much retired now and by and large seems to want to live outside the public eye. I know obviously he's had occasional public appearances. People see him around town in Bloomington. He obviously came back and to a game in February, but it's not like he is maintaining an active, you know, sort of public calendar, even, you know, pre-COVID.
Sure.
And so it's wanting to be respectful to a lot of people who either A, maybe want some privacy in the later years of their lives, or B, just unfortunately are no longer with us and therefore can't defend their actions, their choices, their decisions. And so I tried very hard, and obviously it's up to the reader to make this determination or not, but I tried very, very hard to present that story as, you know, as objectively and platonically as possible, to try and present sort of the, as best I could, the viewpoint that everyone, all the different parties would have brought to that episode, that period in time. Try to present things just as factually as possible, as closely as they were reported at the time and have been reported in the years since. Tried to corroborate a lot of the sort of tall tales and folklore, or disprove, you know, in some cases, that has come out of.
You didn't disprove anything. You know,
the last 20 years.
Those who lived it.
But just try very hard to not write something that had the appearance of picking a side or making, you know, drawing.
Well, you know, that's interesting.
Things like that.
I wrote this down when you said divisive, or I said divisive, or you said divisive just a couple minutes ago. I find it interesting, and we've had many conversations in the years we've known each other about this angle, about this story. I think you can have it both ways. I think you can make the argument that Bob Knight, due to his actions, not his final action, could have been removed as basketball coach, and say they didn't do it the right way. And it's that's, I think, what makes this story interesting, because Bob's track record is Bob's track record. And I'm not here to defend it or otherwise, but it's long and lengthy. And the way it ended didn't have to necessarily be the way it ended because of said track record. And so I could see why you could be mad both ways or confused both ways, because this whole situation was a cluster, you know what?
Yeah, I mean, it was. And I don't think that this is, you know, let me say this. I don't think that this is particularly subjective. I don't think this is me picking a side in saying, you know, just as a neutral observer who understands the sort of, you know, the mechanics of college sports. If you kind of trace everything back to its root in the story, it is rooted in the zero tolerance policy, which emerges out of the Board of Trustees investigation of the Neil Reed allegation.
And the Neil Reed allegation was like the 23rd thing on the list up to that point.
Well, and even disregarding all of that,
that's your Fisher cut bait line, isn't it?
If that's the case, it is very hard to imagine a world where it would have been more difficult for Indiana to make that decision in March 2000 than it was to make that decision in September 2000.
People have argued you don't make it in March of 2000 because the program falls apart. In September, you've got everybody in school getting ready for the season. It's least – I don't know. I don't think they think about it that way.
I think that is definitely one sort of – again, when you want to talk about sort of the folklore and the apocrypha that have surrounded the decision, I think that is definitely one theory that a lot of people believe. I think – quite frankly, you should never a program like Indiana should never be thinking in terms of one roster at one time in one year.
No, that's exactly right. Because
so if that did hold basis in truth,
that's even worse.
It's
bad enough already when they let the players pick the new coach, because Indiana's basketball program is the players come and go. The program is the program. That was another fatal mistake in all this. You want to point that they went to the championship game in 2002? They did, and I will never take that away from those players, but those players should not have been afforded the decision to name in an institution of this size, shape, and stature of a basketball program who is the next coach going to be. That was another massive failure in the hierarchy of how this was handled, in my opinion.
And it's, those decisions aren't always the most popular ones. I remember when Fred Glass took some heat in 2014 for saying, we're Indiana University. We don't play in the CBI, when Indiana didn't make the NIT and we asked, he told a couple of people, I was one of them, the night that Selection Sunday, when Indiana didn't make the NCAA or NIT fields. That was his, I think, pretty much direct quote, we're Indiana, we don't play in the CBI. And so people sort of said, that's a little bit arrogant. And I think certainly from, I think Tom Crean backed Fred's decision, but I think in purely coaching terms, Tom would always look at the opportunity for more full practices with players rather than less is an opportunity.
And trips to Atlanta, interestingly enough.
But in that moment, Fred Glass is sort of exercising what maybe you do feel like if those theories.
You know what?
True,
I'll take this back.
Desire was to keep everything together. The desire was to not do it in March because you wanted to keep everything together, to keep the team together. That's, Fred Glass is kind of laying down a marker and exercising some foresight. Forethought.
Yeah, and the crazy part is we have to talk about the CBI, and we can take that all the way back to Bob Knight's firing of why we're talking about the CBI in 2014.
Possibly, yeah. But it's just about. It's about the degree to which I suppose you hold the program apart from other workings of the university. And again, I'd also underscore it's possible that this is true, but we are talking about one theory that I think, as somebody who dug back through a lot of old newspaper clippings, spoke to more than a half dozen people, is more familiar with the story now than he's ever been. It's not something that was ever really corroborated in fact, but it is,
it makes sense.
It is interesting.
It does. You can make an argument for it one way or another in one day or another. Miles Brand decides to fire Bob Knight. Terry Klapacz, I believe, said in your article something about he thought the incident at Assembly Hall was a nothing incident. The police investigation said it's a nothing incident. And Miles Brand goes to Indianapolis. He's up there at IUPUI and decides to have the biggest announcement in the sporting history of Indiana University from the Indianapolis campus. That kind of told me everything I needed to know about that.
Yeah, and that's fair. And I think that's, again, this does feel a little bit like one of those episodes where, again, speaking as someone who was a doe-eyed seventh grader at Ridgeview Middle School in Sandy Springs, Georgia, when all of this was happening, and therefore really does not have a dog in the fight.
That's why I think your perspective is interesting, because you didn't live through it like the rest of us.
Yeah, I would say that I really would have, at least some sympathy for just about any view, frankly, in all this. It did seem like Brand. I can remember a time, and let's not get too deep into university politics either. even I, as someone who came to Indiana for the first time in 2005, can remember a time when IUPUI, let's not say they were a peer campus to Bloomington, but administratively, it was, you did see the president spending more, splitting his time between the campuses more, splitting his focus potentially between the campuses more than we see now. And I, you know, without wanting again to go too deep into the weeds with something I'm guessing not a lot of people care too much about, I know that there have been times when IUPUI in recent years has expressed a certain level of displeasure with the what is perceived anyway as the increased sort of political influence or whatever term you want to use of Bloomington within the Indiana University system and structure.
Yeah, what's the PU and I stand for in there too? Yeah, I'm,
well, and,
yeah.
And that's fair, but you know, it's if you actually comb through IUPUI's, you know, sort of course offerings and ledgers, and it's very IU. Much an IU university in the same way that IU Purdue Fort Wayne is very heavily influenced by Purdue. You know, IU
the greater point was the president at the time did not handle his business in the campus of the business that needed to be handled. Number two, that same president remarked that athletics aren't a big deal, shouldn't have been a big deal. We're trying to move away from that mantra. And the shocking part about it, in my opinion, living through it and dealing with everything was, and I think this was covered well in the history of the people you talked to, the straw that broke the back wasn't a very big straw. And the insubordination part and everything else made it look like he was out to be gotten, as opposed to, well, he's done all this and everything else. And that's why I say you can make the argument both ways, that sure, you could have told him to take a hike, but the way you told him to take a hike was backwards, wrong, and everything else. And I think that's where the casual fan thinks that the trustees were out to get him. The president was out to get him. Well, because they did everything that made it look that way.
Yeah. I mean, well, and you also have trustees saying things like the, you know, the votes were there to
individually,
fire him
but not as a board, I think was the quote, which I thought was fantastic.
Well,
then you have Miles.
What they meant, there was a strong suggestion throughout that had Miles Brand in May of 2000, when the board's president, John Walda, delivered his report on the whole Neil Reed incident, and I think it was sort of a wider investigation of the culture within the program, had Brand desired, the board would have had the votes to back him to terminate Knight in May of 2000. And Brand, between what was written at the time, what was said at the time, particularly in 2000 by trustees, and also in conversations I had in reporting this story, I believe that Brand in May did not want to do that. And particularly once the zero tolerance structure was put in place, he felt that was the best route forward.
Why? I'm going to ask you to play president for a minute. Why do you think that was the issue? Because he knew he was going to commit something down the road again? Yeah, I think we all knew that Bob wasn't going to change who Bob was. Why give him one more chance to drag the university through this and go through what they did, in your opinion?
No, I think that's fair. I think that, you know, what I would say in that respect is, and you and I talked about this earlier today, you know, the comparison I made was to the contention that people made when Coke launched the new Coke campaign in the 80s and it failed miserably and they were forced to bring back the old formula. There were people who contended that new Coke was all a way to reinvigorate consumers' love for the original Coca-Cola formula, thereby driving sales up significantly when they ditched new Coke for old Coke. And there was a Coca-Cola executive at the time, I forget who it was, who said, you know, we're not that stupid and we're not that smart. In my experience, there are often times when we could talk about this with the Big Ten now too, You know, when there are people who, you know, when there are, when there's a communication void, when people are, when leaders are being opaque, when there's controversy and it's not being addressed head on, you'll see people say, you'll see people assume that it is some sort of nefarious, multi-layered conspiracy. And very often, I sort of, in my experience, I want to look at them knowing what I know and say, they're not that stupid and they're not that smart.
I don't disagree really with that.
It's just people who maybe, with the benefit of hindsight, would have made a different decision. Because I think, to your point, given the long history of public issues, much less potentially private ones, you know,
and that was the thing that was that was a thing that hurt their case, in my opinion, because they brought up the private issues when they had a thousand other things they could have stood behind. No, that's why it made it look bad. And when you dig into that, well, we went after a female person in a meeting. That was like number 218. That was the things that nobody knew about. That's what made it look like a hit job.
And when, again, when there are these sort of clandestine trustees meetings and
violating open door policies.
Yeah, and different things like that. And when
that doesn't help.
It's really easy to do all of this in hindsight. That's the one thing you say, is it's very easy to say all of this with the benefit of hindsight. But you do just sort of, you know, you sometimes feel like you just want to go back and say, hey, are you sure that this is the best way forward? And again, that's not to, I'm not trying to advocate a position. I really am trying to stay
very
you're
not.
Bob Knight neutral.
Because you're annoying me for not taking my side. So that's, I know you're not doing it. So that's good.
Yeah.
But the neutrality part of it, the neutrality part is difficult because no one ever goes to a basketball game and roots for the board of trustees or the president. They root for the team and the coach. And that's what made it they couldn't understand the fan why they wanted to take that away. It's just Bob being Bob. And if you wanted to put all these stigmas and things on him, the great comment from Terry Klaipak, the Assembly Hall, I thought it was a lot to do about nothing. I didn't think it amounted to much. I sent the police out to look at it. The preliminary information, I said it was nothing, really nothing. So you hear all that, but then he's zero tolerance, and it just was set up to fail from the beginning, and it didn't work, sadly. And here we are with Knight at Dunn Meadow, Knight in front of Assembly Hall, and Mick Renheisen said earlier on the program, since that was the largest gathering he's seen, an unorganized gathering he's seen here in Bloomington, maybe since the until this year's Black Lives Matter protest. So that just tells you the scope of everything that went on there. So nobody was happy, and since then, Indiana University basketball has struggled, and I think a lot of that has to do with how it was left, and sadly hasn't regained that footing that Fred Glass and everybody else has dreamed about getting back to reality. So it was no less than a weird. You were in seventh grade, you said, huh?
I was, yeah.
you pup. We were in the airport in Baltimore, Washington. We were getting back from watching.
I guess I might have been in eighth grade. Now that I'm thinking,
we won't hold
it
to you.
Not that that makes it any better.
Middle school. Let's just say middle school.
Yeah.
We were coming back from Indiana beating Maryland and Virginia over the weekend in men's soccer, and we had our IU soccer gear on, getting ready to hop on our plane on a Sunday morning to fly back, and people were coming up to us in the BWI airport and saying, wow, Bob Knight got fired. And this was before you had all news on your phone and everything else. And to say that we didn't see that coming, we didn't see that coming after a big weekend for Jerry Yeagley's crew on the East Coast, and a big weekend for us as well. So that was interesting to hear that, because now you get everything on your phone. We actually had human interaction to tell us about this news 20 years ago. So very interesting. What are you going to do for the 25th anniversary in 5 years?
Hopefully just, if anybody's interested, point them back to what was reported in the year 2020. Again, it's one of those where it's, you know, you can't ignore it, but you do at some point just say, hey, you know, lay this down and let people. And I say that as the person that turned in 5,000 words on this earlier this week. So I understand where that maybe comes off as a little bit sort of humorous to some people. But, you know, it's interesting. And I know we don't have much time left.
No, we got about 30 seconds. You're right.
It was such a cultural event.
Huge cultural event.
It's not even just sort of, it's not Billy Martin with the Yankees. It's not even Joe Torre with the Yankees. It's someone whose importance extended beyond just their sport to a lot of people. Even today, I think if you ask the average person, what do you know about the state of Indiana? Like Bob Knight would be in a lot of people's top three.
I think it'd be in a lot of people's top three over the age of 40.
I think it would be in a number of people's top three over the age of 18. Wow, I really do.
Okay.
I think Peyton Manning would be number one, probably. Sports, maybe this is a separate conversation about sports being too important in society. Yeah, but nevertheless, you were talking about a cultural figure. I'll leave you with this. This got left on the cutting room floor, but it struck me that even
10 seconds.
The pages of the Indianapolis Star, a removed objective news organization, the header on the special section was not the firing of Bob Knight. It was the firing of Coach Knight. That struck me.